illegal immigration problem. The terrorists who hijacked American jetliners on September 11th were all from foreign countries. Some originally had legal visas, but they had expired, and the INS never followed up, never deported them. Others had legal visas, but shouldn't have had them. They were on terrorist watch lists, but no one at the INS ever bothered to check those lists. Nor did the INS inform the U.S. embassies and consulates, or INS and customs officials at major American airports, that these men should have been denied entry into the country in the first place. And then, of course, there's the astonishing story that even 6 months after terrorist Mohammed Atta and his gang flew the separate planes into the Twin Towers, that the INS mailed the approval of their student visa applications to the very flight school where the men learned the skills to complete their ghastly last mission. There are many hardworking, dedicated, and brave INS, Border Patrol, Customs, and other law enforcement officials. No one's saying otherwise. They deserve high praise. They deserve our support. My problem isn't with the men and women who are trying to defend our country, but with the politically driven policies imposed on our immigration system that makes defending our country that much more difficult. Are all illegal immigrants dangerous? Of course not. Are all immigrants who overstay their visas terrorists? No. But do we have any idea which are and which are not? Well, apparently not. And we must do a better job protecting our coastlines and our borders. We need to screen all visa applications more effectively, particularly those from countries known or suspected to be harboring terrorists. We need to cross-check all visa applications against the FBI's terrorist watch list. We need to take special care with those who are granted temporary entry into our country, and we need our colleges and universities to help us track foreign students to make sure that they're really showing up in class, and we need to deport illegal aliens, particularly those who commit additional crimes when they're here on our soil. And that's just for starters. That is not racist. That's just good common sense, the kind of common sense that seemingly escapes many on the left today. In the summer of 2001, President George W. Bush and some of his Republican colleagues on Capitol Hill shocked a lot of people, including me, when they began making noises about passing an amnesty bill for illegal aliens. I said it on radio and TV at the time, and I'll say it again here. Amnesty for illegal aliens is a misguided and perilous notion, and it's no less so when Republicans are behind it. Our side already tried amnesty back in 1986. It didn't work, and since then, millions more illegal immigrants have come into our country, and we ought not repeat our mistake, especially not now after 9/11. We've got to learn from history, and hopefully President Bush and his advisors will reverse course and find a wise balance between sound policy and smart politics. Look, after all, I love the fact that Bush is reaching out to immigrants in general, Hispanics in particular. I feel passionately that the GOP needs to do much more to get our message out to all Americans to counter liberal race baiting in the process. But in the process of this reaching out, we must remain true to our core principle that free people in a free society must honor the rule of law. When an otherwise hardworking and decent person tries illegally to enter this country, a political party must have the courage to say that such conduct is wrong and it's not going to be rewarded. For when people break the law with impunity, the freedoms of everyone are put in jeopardy. It's not racist. And I don't harbor resentment or bitterness about the tough challenges my family faced almost a century ago. And I'm grateful that America welcomed legal immigrants, however imperfectly, back when my grandparents were arriving. And I'm also grateful that America keeps welcoming legal immigrants today as well. I support legal immigration. But we need to ensure that our laws are applied consistently, fairly, and impartially. And of course, we need to be passionate about stamping out racism, religious bigotry, and anti-immigrant sentiment wherever they rear their ugly heads. But we need to be careful not to ascribe such sins to those who simply make a distinction between illegal and legal immigration and want to keep our country safe and secure from all enemies, foreign and domestic. This issue is far too important to be politicized. It must be approached in a way that best promotes our national security while preserving, of course, civil liberties. As I write this, the number one threat to our homeland security comes from sleeper cells, foreign terrorists who have carefully burrowed themselves into our free and open society and are quietly going about their business until their leaders activate or awaken them with orders to carry out another horrific attack. Most of the terrorists who attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and would have attacked the White House or Capitol building were sleepers. Now, they lived among us. They rented apartments, obtained driver's licenses, obtained cars, attended flight schools, ate at restaurants, went to strip clubs, and moved about with little or no fear of being noticed, much less captured. Though the Justice Department, under John Ashcroft's leadership, has done a remarkable job rounding up these terrorists, many remain at large today. And the question our law enforcement officials ask themselves every day, therefore, is how do we find, catch, and imprison them before they strike again? It is a challenge I've sought to underscore from the earliest hours of this crisis. Sleepers have been here for years and may well be planning the next level, a second tier of attacks, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North said on Hannity and Combs just 2 days after the terrorists struck. Quote, the vulnerability that we face is not just from the residuals of those who tried to carry out the bombings on Tuesday and failed because their flights were grounded. We also have that second tier of a relatively unsophisticated attack with an 18-wheeler full of 40,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate and diesel fuel. We've got the FBI looking into some of these student cells. I remind you that the terrorists who tried to kill my family and me in February of 87, North said, got their orders through the People's Committee for Libyan Students, and we know that many of these youngsters have been in American schools where they don't get an education in American democracy and freedom. What they get is ideology that backs them up and engineering skills that allows them to build these bombs. Well, Ali is absolutely right. Sleepers can hit us in any number of ways, when and where we least expect it. Car bombs, truck bombs, suicide bombings like those Israel has suffered through, shootings, kidnappings, hijackings, cyber warfare, the devastating computer viruses, anthrax, or other biological and chemical attacks, poisoning our water supplies, demolition of our dams, bridges, and tunnels, and attacks against our 103 nuclear power plants in America. In our free and open society, the threats are real, the targets are many. Were they successful and severe, a rash of such attacks could catch us by surprise. They could rattle our sense of confidence and security. They could trigger a dramatic public health disaster or even an economic crisis. Top U.S. officials, including the Attorney General, the FBI Director, the Homeland Security Director, and the Defense Secretary, say, quote-unquote, sleeper cells of terrorists are serious threats, and we must be ready to counter them for the foreseeable future. Now, I think it'll take a period of years, said Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in a speech at the National Defense University, warning that the threats will intensify if terrorists get their hands on weapons of mass destruction. Quote, these attacks could grow vastly more deadly than those we suffered in 2001, he said. Some complain that the FBI and other law enforcement officials shouldn't be given new powers to hunt down these terrorists in our midst. They're certainly within their rights to raise concerns about civil liberty protections, and I take a backseat to no one when it comes to championing these rights. But the problem is that some seem to routinely underestimate the magnitude of the threats that we're facing. They don't accept why we so urgently need to remove certain legal handcuffs that have made it far too difficult to track, trace, and trap terrorists. Once you understand the threat of sleeper cells, you begin to understand the importance of getting far more serious about aviation security. Mary Schiavo served as the Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Transportation from 1990 through 1996. After she left government, she wrote a book called Flying Blind, Flying Safe, full of warnings about threats to U.S. aviation security. Schiavo described a 1995 study designed to test the effectiveness of various U.S. airport security teams detecting a bomb being smuggled onto a commercial plane. The results? They were horrifying. New York's Kennedy Airport and Washington Dulles Airport detected the bombs a mere 56% of the time. Boston's Logan Airport only 23% of the time. Los Angeles's LAX an appalling 10% of the time. Schiavo also noted that until the late 1990s, quote, U.S. airlines were not required by law to X-ray passenger baggage, and that overall U.S. aviation security procedures were dangerously lax. She concluded that, quote, it's probably only a matter of time before the security practices used on international flights originating in the U.S. are adopted on domestic flights as well. Now, I hope it does not come about because of a senseless or horrible act of domestic terrorism. But with the 70 attempts on domestic U.S. aviation in the first half of 1997, the future does not look good. Tragically, Schiavo's warnings went unheeded. During the 1990s, the Clinton-Gore team talked tough, but did almost nothing to make U.S. aviation truly safe from terrorism. In July of 1996, for example, just 1 week after the tragic crash of TWA Flight 800 near Long Island and the run-up to the fall presidential elections, President Clinton promised tough new airplane and baggage screening measures, vowing that every flight would be thoroughly checked for terrorists and the tools of terrorism. Quote, every plane, every cabin, every cargo hold, every time, Clinton said at John F. Kennedy Airport. Quote, whatever needs to be done, we'll do it. He announced that Vice President Gore would lead a new aviation security commission and come up with new security requirements within 45 days. On August 6, 1996, Clinton sounded even more determined. Quote, we will not rest in our efforts to track down, prosecute, and punish terrorists and to keep the heat on those who support them. And we must not rest in that effort, he said. The second part of our strategy is to give American law enforcement the most powerful tools available to fight terrorism without undermining our civil liberties. As any of you have flown in recent days will have noticed, he said, we're doing more hand searches and machine screening of luggage. He continued, we're requiring pre-flight inspections on every plane flying to or from the United States, every plane, every cabin, every cargo hold, every time. Clearly, Clinton and Gore knew about the serious threats to U.S. aviation. They talked tough, they had meetings, they issued reports, and they asked Congress for more money. In short, to their credit, they took responsibility for U.S. aviation security. There was just one problem. While many of their recommendations were right on track, they were never transformed into solid, effective, real-world results. Among other things, for example, we learned that despite Clinton-Gore rhetoric, hardly any planes and bags were given thorough security checks. According to industry experts, a Boston Globe editorial noted on October 11, 2001, no more than 5% of all luggage checked at U.S. airports gets inspected by such explosive device detection equipment. The percentage is likely to fall as restrictions on the number of carry-on bags lead to more luggage being checked. What's the problem? Quote, the slowness of installing and utilizing the devices can be blamed on the federal government's half-hearted approach and the reluctance of airlines to take on the expense of operating and maintaining the machines, the Globe noted. Quote, the government is paying for the devices, but on a schedule that is not slated to have all baggage checked until 2017. That's right, 2017. On September 24, 2001, in the wake of the attacks in New York and in Washington, I interviewed former Inspector General Schiavo on Hannity and Combs. Mary, I've got to tell you something, I began. I think America is in a debt of gratitude to you. You have been sounding an alarm bell about airline safety for over a decade. I bet this is one case where you wish you were wrong, but you were not. I wish I was very wrong on this, she conceded. I would give all I have to be wrong on this, but I and my former employees at the Office of Inspector General and many others had warned the FAA for well over a decade that the problems were coming. With radical Islamic sleeper cells in America today, we continue to face the threat of airborne attacks. We need to get serious about airport and airplane security. We need real baggage checks and background checks. We need far more armed federal marshals on our planes. And I believe that airline pilots should be trained in the use of handguns and that they should be armed. In many other ways, the Bush administration has moved in the right direction since 9/11, but they must move far more aggressively. The administration, for example, has opposed proposals to arm pilots, a position I think is wrong and a position I believe could be dangerous. One of the unintended consequences of 9/11 was that it forced us all to take stock of our values, to make some hard-nosed choices about who we are, what we believe, and what we choose to teach our children and pass on to future generations. Most of us instinctively rediscovered our deep and abiding love for our families, our friends, our neighbors, our devotion to and love of our country, and our deep, devout faith in a loving, holy God. You know, amidst all the pain, sadness, horror, we have reaffirmed our love, our patriotism, and our faith, and we did so unashamed. We began flying American flags on our homes and cars and wearing pins of Old Glory on our lapels. We began attending church and synagogue for prayer and vigils. We began gathering in schools and fire halls, community centers, and VFW posts to express our solidarity. School kids began saying the Pledge of Allegiance again, singing Irving Berlin's great hymn of the 20th century, God Bless America, and decorating their schools with red, white, and blue flags, banners, and bunting. For all the cynicism and divisiveness that seemed to dog us in the 1990s, suddenly we were brought together in a way that harkened back to the 1940s and World War II. We were all proud patriots again, with few exceptions. For many years now, this country's values have been under attack by a persistent cadre of people eager to remove God and prayer from our public schools, denigrating our history and our flag, assaulting our culture and our traditions. And sadly, September 11th didn't jolt them back to their senses. This fringe movement opposes overt displays of patriotism, especially in our schools and other public facilities. From waving the flag to reciting the Pledge of Allegiance to singing the national anthem and God Bless America. But in many cases, it's more than just the expressions of loyalty to the nation that rankle them. They also bristle at the Declaration of Independence and what they seem to think it represents. Too often, what drives them is a basic revulsion for what this nation stands for. And that's tragic and ironic, considering that in many nations, they wouldn't have the freedom to register such dissent. There are several reasons beyond their rhetoric that the left fiercely resists teaching America's children the Declaration of Independence and the Pledge of Allegiance in our public schools today. Here are just three. First, liberals absolutely abhor and militantly reject the founders' belief in absolute truth. America's founders believed deeply in certain fundamental truths about life, liberty, and the nature of man. In fact, they believe they weren't just inserting lofty, sounding, but meaningless platitudes in the document, that such truths were self-evident. By sharp contrast, the left embraces moral relativism with an arrogant tenacity. The existence of absolute truths would mean liberals couldn't ignore certain inalienable rights, such as the supremacy of the right to life, because it would mean that they wouldn't be free to amend them at their whim. When everything is relative, the distinctions between right and wrong, good and evil, are obviously blurred. This suits the dogma and the purposes of the left, yet nothing could be further from the expressed beliefs and intentions of the founders, which is precisely why the left omits those history lessons and lobbies for the abandonment of any fixed standards. Second, liberals flat-out reject the founders' belief that we are, quote-unquote, created and endowed by our Creator at all, much less with unalienable rights. To teach children that we were created equal requires teaching them that we were created in the first place, and teaching children that there is a Creator, an all-powerful, supernatural God, is abhorrent to the left. This was routine in public schools prior to the two Supreme Court decisions in the early 1960s. The existence of God means the existence of absolute truth and fixed moral standards. Moreover, acknowledging the existence of God is to concede that the federal government is not the highest authority. And third, and perhaps most prevalent, liberals condemn the founders for preaching equality while refusing to end the hideous inhumanity of slavery. This charge, in which the founding fathers are dismissed as bigots and racist, has been repeated often by the left. For this reason, I'll spend some time addressing it. In declaring independence from England, and in the adoption of a constitution, the founders believed it was critical that the colonies, later the states, act unanimously. And the truth is that the founders struggled with the issue of slavery when debating both the Declaration and the Constitution. In autobiographical notes penned in 1821, Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, recalled that when the Congress was considering the Declaration, the clause reprobating the enslaving of inhabitants of Africa was struck out in compliance to South Carolina and Georgia, who had never attempted to restrain the importation of slaves and who, on the contrary, still wished to continue it. In October of 1787, James Madison, perhaps the most important contributor to the Constitution, wrote Jefferson about the debate at the Constitutional Convention over slavery. Quote, he said, "Some contended for an unlimited power over trade, including exports as well as imports, slaves as well as other imports. Some for such power, provided the concurrence of 2/3 of the power with an exemption of exports and slaves, others for an exemption of exports only. The result is seen in the Constitution. South Carolina and Georgia were inflexible on the point of slaves. And the result Madison referred to was the framers' attempt to limit the institution of slavery in the Constitution itself, Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution empowered Congress to abolish the importation of slaves by 1808. Moreover, Article 1, Section 2 effectively reduced the number of slave state congressmen who could serve in the House of Representatives, thereby limiting the influence of the slave states in Congress by counting slaves as, quote-unquote, three-fifths of all other persons for purposes of apportioning representation. This three-fifths language has understandably been the subject of great controversy over the years, but what has usually been absent from the discussion is the fact that commentators at the time saw the framers' efforts as an important first step toward eventually abolishing slavery. For example, in the fall of 1788, the Philadelphia's Independent Gazette published several essays about the Constitution, which included this observation, quote, "The importation of slaves from any foreign country is, by a clear implication, held up to the world as equally inconsistent with the dispositions and the duties of the people of America. A solid foundation is laid for exploding the principles of Negro slavery, in which many good men of all parties in Pennsylvania and throughout the Union have already concurred. The temporary reservation of any particular matter must be deemed an admission that it should be done away. This appears to have been well understood. In addition to the arguments drawn from liberty, justice, and religion, opinions against this practice, founded in sound policy, have no doubt been urged. Regard was necessarily paid to the peculiar situation of our Southern fellow citizens, but they, on the other hand, have not been insensible of the delicate situation of our national character on this subject." Unquote. Slavery continued to haunt the Founding Fathers after the adoption of the Constitution. In March in 1790, Thomas Paine, who helped foment the American Revolution with his widely read pamphlet, Common Sense, wrote Dr. Benjamin Rush, himself a signer of the Declaration, quote, "I wish most anxiously to see my much-loved America. It is the country from whence all reformations must originally spring. I despair of seeing an abolition of the infernal traffic in Negroes. We must push that matter further on your side of the water. I wish that a few well-instructed Negroes could be sent among their brethren in bondage, for until they are enabled to take their own party, nothing will be done." And of course, some 27 years later, the issue came to a head. From 1861 to 1865, fellow countrymen, friends, and even relatives took up arms against each other in the bloodiest war in American history, in which both the fate of the Union and slavery were decided. Slavery will always be a deplorable stain on our history, but for the principles enunciated in the Declaration of Independence and adopted by the colonies, however, there would have been no American Revolution, no United States, no Constitution, and no war to end slavery. The Declaration is a document that celebrates liberty. Its authors and signers deserve our praise and thanks, not our disdain, for they put in place the ability to correct wrongs and injustices so the future generations would proudly want to say the Pledge of Allegiance. To many, our public schools have become liberal indoctrination centers, cultural battlegrounds, and poorly performing graduation factories. Modern liberal elitists since the 1960s have largely taken control of our educational establishment, motivated by an aversion to many of the traditional values and principles upon which this nation was founded, and to Western civilization in general, they de-emphasize and distort them in their revised versions of history. Instead of proudly acknowledging our heritage, they apologize for it. Where fair-minded students of history see America as a grand and noble experiment, they see it as racist, sexist, homophobic, and unjust. The left seeks to extinguish virtually all references to God, Judeo-Christian beliefs, and the Bible in our public schools. And tried-and-true educational techniques are frequently replaced with unproven, experimental teaching methods. This has all contributed to the rapid decline of the quality of education that our students receive. Sure, listen, there are great schools, there are great teachers out there, but overall, K-12 education in America is an unmitigated disaster. It's appalling, it's immoral, and it's unjust, especially in America's inner cities, and the only way to really fix this is to get radical, to set parents free to choose the schools and the teachers and the systems that work best for their children. Now, that's not going to be easy. In fact, It's going to take a mini revolution to make this all happen. But that's exactly what we need. Too many children in our country are being cheated. Too many are being warehoused. Too many are being denied their civil right to a decent education and a shot at the American dream. And I, for one, can't sit by and watch the destruction of another generation's future. If we as a nation truly solve our educational problems, if we ensure that all of our kids are free to go to schools where they'll learn to read and write and think and do math and science and understand the difference between right and wrong, we'll go a long way towards solving a wide range of other social problems, from drug use and crime and teen pregnancy and welfare dependency. But if we continue to trap kids in dirty, dangerous, dilapidated, drug-infested schools, we'll be playing Russian roulette with six bullets. The crisis in American education isn't new, and that's what's so infuriating. In April of 1983, a landmark study entitled A Nation at Risk was presented to President Reagan and to the American people by the National Commission on Excellence in Education. Its findings were startling, its conclusions sobering. Quote, "The educational foundations of our society are presently being eroded by a rising tide of mediocrity that threatens our very future as a nation and a people," that report began, adding that, quote, "If an unfriendly foreign power had attempted to impose on America the mediocre educational performance that exists today, we might as well have viewed it as an act of war," unquote. Worse, the report found that the gains in student achievement we'd made in the 1950s and early 1960s in response to the urgent needs of the Cold War to outperform the students of the Soviet Union and other communist countries had long since been squandered by an educational bureaucracy that no longer placed an emphasis on high standards and world-class achievement. We have, in effect, been committing an act of unthinking, unilateral educational disarmament, the report concluded. Liberals say we're not spending enough money to solve the problem, but that's simply not true. We've invested hundreds of billions of dollars in reforming our public schools over the past two decades, and we're spending more money today than at any other time in our history. Adjusting for inflation, we spend about 70% more on education today than we did when that report, A Nation at Risk, was first being researched. Federal spending on education alone has nearly doubled since the 1980s, and during the 1999-2000 school year, combined federal, state, and local spending on kindergarten through 12th grade education hit $389 billion. That's about $100 billion more than we spent on defense, and in constant dollars, average per pupil spending on K through 12 education has soared from $3,367 in 1970 to $6,584 in the year 2000. The question isn't whether we're spending enough money, because we are. The question is whether we're seeing dramatically improved results as a result of our investment. And the painful truth is, we are not. In fact, the results have been disastrous. Now, how is this possible? How have we let things get this bad? Well, I can tell you here in New York, where I work each and every day, the public school system is an absolute abomination. Now, there are a few great schools, but the grim truth is that hundreds of thousands of children in this city are being locked into institutionalized failure. Last year, for example, 36% of the students in the city of New York's high schools failed to meet the state's English and math standards. And worse, 56% of the city's children in city elementary schools and 77% of the kids in city's middle schools failed to meet those standards. At one school in the Bronx, an unbelievable 73% of the kids flunked basic reading. The year before, 60% had flunked. And if all that weren't bad enough, city and state education officials didn't seem to have a clue about what was going wrong. Is it teaching? Asked State Education Commissioner Richard Mills. Is it teaching practice? Is it the material? Is it the work students are doing? What are they reading? What are they writing? What kind of math problems are they doing? What are these people doing with our tax dollars if they don't even know the answer to these questions? For one thing, they're sending a record number of kids to summer school. You know, during the summer of 2001, for example, nearly one in three students in the New York City public schools, that's almost 330,000 children, at a cost of some $175 million, were required to attend summer classes because they couldn't pass basic proficiency tests during the regular school year. But even that hasn't done much good. In recent years, school officials have actually held back a record number of students because they couldn't pass their tests even at the end of summer school. In New York, as well as nationwide, we also have an incredibly serious teacher quality crisis. Sure, listen, many teachers around the country are first rate, but far from all of them are. I remember a report back in the late 1980s indicating that almost 1 in 5 young people applying to become public school teachers were actually flunking their certification exams, even though the exam itself was believed by critics to be too easy to begin with. Even those who did pass aren't exactly up to snuff. And it's not just New York, of course. This education abomination is evident in cities all over this great country, and it absolutely infuriates me. So who's going to stick up for these kids? Who will see that they have a chance in life? Who will be their advocate when the very school system designed to help them is their own worst enemy? Now, you think I'm critical of urban education? Well, you need to meet Joe Clark, the African-American former principal of Eastside High School, an inner-city school in Paterson, New Jersey. Clark practically is a legend in the history of modern public schools. He almost single-handedly battled the entire liberal public school establishment in an attempt to drive drug pushers and gangbangers and other deadbeats from the high school that he ran. And he fought to raise standards, and he fought to inspire teachers and students, and he fought to give parents and their children and their community some hope where most hope had been lost. And his story was so inspiring that it was turned into a fantastic Hollywood film. It's called Lean on Me. By the way, if you haven't seen it, go rent it today. But that didn't stop the powers that be from trying to get rid of him anyway, proving that no good deed goes unpunished when it comes to the liberal education bureaucracy. Now, I've interviewed Joe Clark many times over the years, not just because he knows the strengths and weaknesses of public schools inside and out, but also because this guy is a hero. He's been there. He knows how badly parents feel when they see their kids trapped in schools that are awful, and he understands the moral necessity of setting all those parents free. I want to ask Joe this, I told him one night on Hannity and Combs. Look, I'm a big supporter of vouchers. We spend $380 billion a year on education. If you have those schools competing for that $380 billion prize, you're going to see excellence in education because the parents are going to send their kids to the schools where there's discipline, where there are no problems, where their kids will get a good education, and where we'll see the test scores go through the roof, right? You agree? Yes, I'm a supporter of teachers, Clark responded. I'm a supporter of public education. And let me just state this for the record. Teachers, by and large, do a good job under adverse circumstances. They're overworked, underpaid, and denigrated for everything that goes wrong. But basically, public education, especially in the inner city, is brain dead. It's the dog that won't hunt because it's antithetical to the premise of democracy, which is free enterprise. When Allen began to disagree about vouchers, Clark didn't back down. I can say this to you, Clark told him. The Ku Klux Klan must be jubilant over the fact that the lives of black individuals in the inner city are being categorically destroyed. Now, I thought Allen was going to have a stroke. And let me go one step further, Clark continued. If private schools are good enough for Congress and the Black Caucus, then it should be good enough for the downtrodden in the city. A few months later, Clark was gracious enough to come back on Hannity and Combs and clarify his case even further. I certainly believe in the voucher system, he told Allen and me. I think that the government school is antithetical to the premise of democracy, which is competition. If there's no competition, there can't be any accountability. Adding a few moments later that, quote, our government educational system is an abomination. It's the epitome of fraud and hypocrisy when you're turning out in the inner cities black American kids who are impotent intellectually. That's wrong. That immediately drew a strong reaction from Nadine Strossen, who is the left-wing, anti-parental choice national president of the American Civil Liberties Union. Well, Strossen protested, I think it's wrong to remove control of education from the public and put it in the hands of private individuals who are unaccountable and then require other people in the public to finance it. Clark responded by turning the tables on Strossen. I'm sure that the Ku Klux Klan is ecstatic over you left-wing liberals opposing parental choice, Clark said, not surprisingly, sparking heated reaction. You want to equate the liberals with being in the pocket of the Ku Klux Klan, Allen said, incredulous. Is that what you believe? I want to equate them with doing something diabolical, Clark shot back, especially to black Americans in this country, yes. Later, Clark added that When you begin to talk about vouchers, people begin to hiss and snarl like a vampire before a cross of garlic, noting that for liberals, quote, it's not about the young people, about the kids, it's about the almighty dollar. Well, Joe Clark is right. Black and Hispanic children are being destroyed by horrifying inner-city public schools. Yet rather than fight for truly equal education for all children, regardless of race, creed, or national origin, liberals whine and complain about money. They focus on saving the education establishment rather than serving the children's interests. They insist on controlling how every single education dollar is spent in this country, and they cry bloody murder if anyone suggests that a parent could spend that money better than a bureaucrat. Moreover, liberal hypocrisy particularly abounds on the issue of school choice. Rich and powerful liberals, they love to send their own children to private schools to escape the abomination of urban education, but they refuse to set urban and minority parents free to choose good, safe, clean schools for their own children. Bill Clinton, he went to a Catholic school when he was a kid. Bill and Hillary, they sent Chelsea to a private school rather than a Washington, D.C. public school when they lived in the White House. Al Gore went to a private school, and Alan Tipper sent their kids to private schools when they served in government. Ted Kennedy, he sent his kids to private school. So did Jesse Jackson. In fact, one out of every five members of the Congressional Black Caucus sends their kids to private schools, as does 40% of every member of the House of Representatives and a whopping 49% of senators who have school-aged children. This is precisely the kind of segregation that Joe Clark and other school choice advocates are battling and the kind of hypocrisy that they detest. Let's look a little deeper and see how the elitist culture is downgrading and damaging the public school curriculum. American history is a story of hope, of progress, of a great adventure in pursuit of more freedom and opportunity for every man, woman, and child. We seek to pass on its lessons to succeeding generations. It's the right thing to do. Now, my wife, Jill, and I, we have two young kids, ages 3 and 1, and as they grow up, we want them to learn about our country's past. In this way, they'll come to understand the incredible sacrifices of past generations that make us such a great people and nation today. They'll learn about America's central role in winning two world wars, including defeating Nazism and ending the Holocaust. They'll learn about America's victory over the Soviet Union, including ending the regime's iron grip on most of Eastern Europe. By understanding and appreciating what came before, my children and all children exposed to America's past will be better prepared to contribute to their generation and generations to come. Jill and I probably will send our kids to Catholic schools one day, but it's not just because we want them to learn theology there. We simply want them in a disciplined, safe, and morally positive environment that reinforces the values and principles we're trying to teach them at home. We're not convinced that's going to happen in a lot of the public schools. And we're fortunate in that if we choose private school for our children, that at this time in my life, I earn enough money to pay for it. But you know what? Many parents can't. They have no choice but to accept whatever quality of education is offered by their local public school. And the problem isn't just the attacks on the pledge or the rejection of the declaration in our classrooms that I discussed in the previous chapter. Our public schools are dumbing down the curriculum, they're lowering academic standards, they're rewriting history, and promoting multiculturalism, which really means demonizing Western civilization. For example, one Monday morning in January 2002, I woke up, headed to the radio studio at WABC in New York, and went online to scan the headlines of FoxNews.com. I also check out the Drudge Report, newspaper websites from all over the country. One story just jumped out at me. It was written by Ellen Sorkin. She's a reporter for the Washington Times, and it was all about how the liberals in the New Jersey Department of Education had just written a new set of history standards. Just one problem. They'd left out any mention of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, the Pilgrims, and the Mayflower. And they also banned the word war, preferring that teachers talk about conflict instead. Now, how in the world are you supposed to teach kids the lessons of American history if you willfully ignore its most important people and events? The answer, of course, is that you cannot. Needless to say, this incredible article, which you should note was written after 9/11, was my lead topic on that day's radio show. And I expressed my distress at what New Jersey was doing to its school children, and my audience was troubled. They were angered as well. So you can imagine my satisfaction when I logged onto the Washington Times website the following Saturday and read Sorkin's follow-up story, headline, Founding Fathers Given New Life in New Jersey. It seems that State Board Commissioner William L. Labrera was reversing course. Now, he was insisting that the New Jersey history standards reflect actual American and New Jersey history. Quote, the names of these individuals must remain in the curriculum, he said. We have an obligation to make sure that our schools are helping our young people understand the critical role these leaders have played in our states and our nation's history. Sorkin further noted that Labrera also added the names of Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon B. Johnson, and Martin Luther King, all of whom were missing from the original revised version of the standards. The left has engaged in this battle in state after state and even at the national level. During the first Bush administration, conservative education experts set up a national committee to develop solid history standards. The goal was to give states, local school systems, and textbook publishers a set of useful voluntary guidelines that they could use to craft stronger, more accurate, more useful history courses. It was a good idea until the revisionists intervened. By the time the national history standards were released, with input from the Clinton-Gore administration in 1994, American history had been radically reconstructed to conform to the liberal agenda. The Ku Klux Klan was mentioned 17 times. McCarthyism was mentioned 19 times. Students were encouraged to understand the emotional appeal of left-wing labor unions, including singing songs about the Depression and, quote-unquote, which side are you on? But never mentioned Paul Revere, Thomas Edison, Daniel Webster, Robert E. Lee, the Wright brothers, Alexander Graham Bell, Henry Clay, or Jonas Salk. George Washington was mentioned only in passing. Gary Nash, head of the History Standards Project, defended such omissions, claiming it was time to, quote-unquote, bury American education's historic approach to teaching history. He said, quote, let's let the kids out of the prison of facts, the prison of dates, the names and places, and let's have them discuss really important, momentous turning points in American history, said Nash. This is unadulterated psychobabble. Just ask any serious historian how much meaningful history can be taught without reference to historical facts. Now, tragically, the left has a virtual monopoly control over the public education system. Through the NEA and its 2.6 million members, they largely determine who teaches our children and what our children are taught. As a result, America's youth have been forced to pay a very high price. And what is most troubling is that the educational establishment in this country seems to spend more of its time, energy, and more money trying to impose their values on our children than it does trying to ensure a quality education for them. On October 1st, 2001, I ran across the following headline on the Washington Post website. September 11th prompts lesson review, educators rethink multiculturalism. At first, I thought the Liberal Post was actually reporting that some of America's most liberal educators had decided to ditch several decades of multicultural madness, but I couldn't have been more wrong. Those people who said we don't need multiculturalism, that it's too touchy-feely, well, a pox on them, said Judith Rizzo, the Deputy Chancellor for Instruction in the New York City public school system. Quote, I think they've learned their lesson. We have to do more to teach habits of tolerance, knowledge, and awareness of other cultures. We are preparing our kids for the 21st century. We have to teach them what is. Now, here is one of the highest-ranking and most influential educators in the country, responsible for the education of hundreds of thousands of children in the city that had just been brutally attacked, claiming that the lesson of 9/11 was that we Americans needed to be more tolerant of others, presumably of those intolerant of us to have murdered 3,000 of our fellow citizens. 4 days after the Post story was published, Liz Cheney, the wife of the vice president and former U.S. Secretary of Education, gave a speech in Dallas. Taking great issue with Rizzo, Cheney talked about the need to teach our children our history, as well as about other peoples and cultures. Unquestionably, Cheney is correct. Parents have been fleeing to private schools, and many are turning to homeschooling to escape the substandard education and distorted values being imposed on our children. But it is imperative that the education establishment be held accountable as well, because far too many children have nowhere else to learn. And as criminal as it is to relegate children to academic inferiority, we must also be aware of the collective effect this will have on our nation itself. Simply put, this nation will not remain great unless it returns to its roots of academic excellence. We can do it. We must do it. Something has got to change. Remember back in the 1930s and 40s when our parents were going to school and the biggest problems we faced in our school systems were kids talking in class, chewing gum, running in the halls? Well, today, in addition to woefully inadequate standards, curriculum, and test scores, we face an epidemic of teen pregnancy, suicide, drug abuse, gangs, metal detectors, school shootings, and a deeply disturbing disrespect for authority and for life in general. More government rules and regulations aren't helping. More government money isn't helping. Neither are more government studies and more political speeches. So what's the answer? The answer is to permit competition to improve education. And that means more accountability. It means more public school choice, more charter schools, private schools, parochial schools, homeschools, and even same-sex schools. It means more vouchers, tuition tax credits, and educational savings accounts, and whatever else it takes to break the nearly total government monopoly on K through 12 education in this country. School choice works because freedom works. Just ask parents in Milwaukee. Just ask parents in Cleveland or those in Indianapolis, Washington, D.C., New York City, and elsewhere whose children are participating in small pilot voucher programs. And they'll tell you how grateful that they are for the chance to give their kids something better than they had before. Indeed, a 1996 analysis by Professor Paul E. Peterson of Harvard University and Professor J.P. Green of the University of Houston found that both reading and math scores of students participating in the school choice program for at least 3 to 4 years were demonstrably higher than control group students in public schools. In fact, the professors concluded that, quote, if similar success could be achieved for all minority students nationwide, it could close the gap separating white and minority test scores by somewhere between one-third and more than one-half, unquote. Vouchers would work for both parents and students. The problem isn't the voucher program. The problem is that closed-minded liberals won't let the program expand, so every parent has the freedom to choose. First of all, kids who go to Catholic schools, even in urban areas, tend to do better academically than those who attend public schools. It's undeniable. A 1990 Rand Corporation study of New York City students found that only 1 in 4 public high school students graduated, while 95% of Catholic students in New York graduated. Moreover, only 16% of public school students took the SATs, however flawed, while a full 75% of students in Catholic schools did. It's no wonder, then, that the Milwaukee School Choice Program has been a huge success and that it's gained a surprisingly diverse group of admirers along the way. Launched in 1990, it was truly a bipartisan effort supported by then-Governor Tommy Thompson, a white conservative Republican, and State Representative Annette Polly Williams, a black liberal Democrat, who ran Jesse Jackson's presidential campaigns in Wisconsin in 1984 and 1988. More than 10,000 low-income and mostly minority students participate in the Milwaukee program, and during the 2001-2002 school year, they used vouchers worth about $5,700, and 91 participating private and parochial schools participated in the choice program with great success. Though opponents strenuously objected, Representative Williams stood firm. Low-income families are not dumb, she said. They're just poor. You give them money, and you can't tell the difference. Choice is the best thing that has come around for my people since I've been born. It allows poor people to have those choices that all those other people who are fearing it already have. So will giving parents choice harm the public schools? Just the opposite, she said. Quote, we're constantly funding failure in the public schools. We need to begin funding success and excellence. Polly Williams is absolutely right, says one of the biggest supporters of the Milwaukee School Choice Program, Howard Fuller, the man who used to be the superintendent of the Milwaukee Public Schools. Fuller completely rejects the notion that the public schools are threatened in any way by giving parents the freedom to make decisions on behalf of their own children. In fact, he's repeatedly and bravely taken on his colleagues in the public school establishment when they've tried to criticize, undermine, or destroy the city school choice experiment. Also cutting against the grain in support of school choice is Milwaukee Mayor John Norquist. but he's no George W. Bush compassionate conservative Republican. He's a Democrat and darn proud of it. He, too, rejects the attacks made by fellow liberals against parents. There's nothing wrong, he points out, with creating real competition in education, nor is there anything wrong with letting religious schools compete with public and private schools to win the trust and support of parents. Quote, there's something fundamentally wrong with a system where what the parents think isn't very important, says Mayor Norquist, dismissing left-wing attacks against religious schools. Quote, for kids in our inner city, there's greater threats to their lives than religion. Norquist is exactly right and deserves great credit for standing up to the liberal naysayers in his own party. When Vice President Al Gore attacked Milwaukee's school choice program during a speech to the anti-voucher NEA, for example, the mayor and his team took exception to their party leader's remarks. Quote, school choice will not harm public schools. In fact, it will push them to improve, said Norquist spokesman Jeff Fleming. School choice is a reality in Milwaukee, and we invite the vice president to visit and see the results. Improved educational opportunity for all Milwaukee students. As a Democrat, was Norquist once skeptical of school choice? Yes, he was, Fleming told the reporter. But Representative Williams helped change his mind. Well, good for her. Other evidence in favor of school choice is mounting. In February 2002, researchers at Harvard and the University of Wisconsin released the findings of their three-year study of a voucher-like school choice program in New York City. Unlike in Milwaukee, the vouchers in New York are paid for by a charitable foundation, not the taxpayers. But beginning in 1997, some 1,300 vouchers called scholarships worth $1,400 have been used each year by low-income elementary school students who qualify for the federal school lunch program. The result has been fascinating. In the first year of the program, 20,000 families applied for just 1,300 slots. Now, that's a powerful testament to the interest other poor parents have in choosing a better school for their children. A full 85% of the students who were accepted into the program were below-average students, countering the liberal attack that school choice programs only pick, quote, the cream of the crop, the best students who will easily achieve higher test scores down the road. To the contrary, teachers in the private school system that participate in the School Choice Scholarship Foundation program specifically want to work with disadvantaged, at-risk children, and they are clearly making a difference. Test scores for choice participants are demonstrably and significantly higher than public school students of similar status in a control group and